You're listening to the Technology Whisperers with my host,
Sean Muller.
And I'm Alistair Ross. And today it's episode 7. We're going to talk about quantum computing, Sean, aren't we just?
This one's going to be one of those deep technical where we try and take the deep technical and raise it up a little bit so that people can start to understand the who, what, why, when, where, so that they could start to get their heads wrapped around it.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone just as sort of background research for this episode. I went on to Wikipedia and just pages like that just to try and grok some of the information out there. Now, I have a more than a passing interest in quantum computing myself, but I'm going to be asking you for your expertise a lot. But I had a quick look, and some of the stuff out there is still incredibly complex. I mean, really, really. Yeah. I mean, like, you need to have an understanding of quantum mechanics, quantum physics, all that sort of stuff. It's just a really, really tough session. So what, yeah, absolutely, hearing you there, Sean, that's why we are the Technology Whisperers. We like to demystify technology out there. So look, without further ado, Sean, in general terms, let's just set the scene here. General terms, what the heck is quantum computing?
Okay, so it's worthwhile us starting at a baseline, and this one will be right in your wheelhouse, Alistair. If we talk about classical computing, right, what we're talking about is that all of computing, all of flops within the processing happen at a bit level. So a bit is either a zero or one. The bit is either turned on or it's turned off. And in fact, if we go down, you know, either classic enough or we go down to a small enough granular level, it's literally a switch. And in fact, if we go all the way back to Alan Turing during World War II, when he built his physical computer, one of the very first computers that ever existed, each bit was a physical switch that you could put your hand on and switch it back and forth. And then the program would go through and switch the switches back and forth. So at a bit level, everything is either a zero or a one.
On now, or off.
Yeah, on or off. That's right. So we've gone microprocessor, smaller, 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 7 nanometer, smaller, 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 pack more, more switches onto processors. We get, you know, greater and greater teraflops and Moore's law shows us a progression of they get faster and faster and faster, right?
A flop, by the way, is a floating point operation. Is that right?
Yeah.
So it's a bit of math, so, basically.
Yeah, it's literally a piece of math done within the code. Now, since the 1960s and slightly there before, there was always been this supposition that if we, instead of being digital, binary, of 0, 1, if we could actually go down to more than one possible, like either a 0 or a 1, or both 0 and 1, that there's this idea that the speed at which we could compute would be exponentially larger, much, much, much larger. And some of the early papers in the late 1960s, early 1970s were around this idea that quantum mechanics might be able to provide the capability to be able to do, so we could compute using quantum level particles, whether they're electrons, whether they're light waves, whatever those are, because quantum particles have special properties. A quantum particle, so if you imagine a tiny subatomic particle, let's say it's spinning top to bottom, right? That might be a one. Spinning bottom to top in reverse might be a zero. But until you look at it, it can actually be spinning both ways at the same time. Now, that sounds like magic, but it's quantum mechanics. It's physics at a quantum layer. And as we all know from Ant-Man and Ant-Man 2, when you get down to the quantum layer, things don't work the way they work up here in, you know, the non-quantum layer. So there was this idea in the 60s and 70s. The problem was, and there are a couple of other weird things going on. So Einstein found this thing called spooky action at a distance. And what that means is that two quantum particles could become entangled, and one of them could be taken across to the other side of the world, and you make a change to one and then look at it and instantaneously see the change to the other one. So everybody knows the maximum speed that anything can go is the speed of light, right? quantum entanglement is instantaneous. So we could have a particle on the Earth and a particle on the moon, and you could send communication back and forth by switching one particle on one side, and instantaneously the particle on the other side changes.
That's pretty heavy stuff. So yeah. So just on the topic of talking about how we have computing in our current life, right? We're used to digital ones and zeros. They are called bits. Now, in quantum computing, we don't have bits in the same fashion. Like you said, there's some sort of more ethereal kind of things. They're called qubits, right? Yes. That's what the denomination is.
Yeah, they've called them qubits to give an example, to give a name to the product that they're doing it. But
and that's just unlike, a quantum bit, isn't it? That's what that stands for.
It is. It is absolutely a quantum bit. But quantum bits can be a lot of things. So Honeywell has built a quantum computer based on light waves. And so their qubits are light waves. IBM has built a quantum computer using very, very, very small strips of metal. And those strips of metal operate the way a quantum particle works. And they have to cool that all the way almost down to absolute zero. And for those that don't remember high school chemistry, absolute zero, 0 degrees Kelvin, is where atomic particles stop moving. Everything freezes as we get down towards zero Kelvin. And so the massive refrigeration units to be able to make this work. There are several quantum computers that are currently in production right now that are actually using electrons to be able to do this. And by the way, every single one of them does it slightly differently. And how they measure the quantum state, whether it's a spin state, whether it's a positive versus a negative within the quantum particle they're using as the qubit, determines what it is that measures. But all of them share in common the fact that they can be on, they can be off, and they can be both at the same time.
Yeah, so we really sound like we're at the Wild West, the very beginning of this, like we were in the 1950s and 40s with digital computing. We just moved out of an age of mechanical computing, really, with the difference engine, the Babbage sort of stuff. And then we got into this thought process of having digital electronics with valves and then later the transistor. So now, is it fair to say that we are in the beginning stages of that sort of epoch with quantum computing, right?
Yeah, we really are. But I want to be clear about this, because physicists have been working on quantum computing since the 60s and 70s. What we are is in the, we're in the cowboy or wild west, the early days of real usable quantum computers. And I want to touch on something for a second. A minute ago, I said, you know, we talked about Moore's law, how the compute processing of a computer, according to Moore's law, which, by the way, is not a law, but a supposition, that the computing capacity will double every year, right?
Yeah.
A quantum computer is capable of being 158 million times faster than any supercomputer we currently have.
Right. So which leads me to my next question. Why does quantum computing matter? Because there's lots of people out there right now who have heard about quantum computing and heard all the science stuff and then gone, so what? So there we're about to touch on some major development here. So why does all of that computing power matter? What are we actually going to use it for?
Yeah. So right now we can only do all the quantum computers that exist are very narrow, specific mathematical solving. And in fact, quantum supremacy was announced by Google, and then it was announced by IBM, or it was announced by IBM and then Google. And it's gone back and forth a couple of times, but all of those quantum supremacies were based on one mathematical problem.
So not general purpose computing like we have today. Like we use computers for vast arrays of different jobs. We're talking about one specific job that quantum computers are doing. Right, okay.
That's correct. Now, these mathematical problems are problems that a classical computer would take 10,000 years to solve. I want to say that again. The quantum computer can solve in minutes what would take a classical computer 10,000 years to solve.
That's a big number.
Yeah. That's why there are so many people, governments, very large multinationals that are pouring billions. That's why Australia has poured $20 billion into a quantum computing center in, I think it's in Canberra or New South Wales, someplace, because the potential of this computer. Now, so you know better than most people, when we start looking at current modern processors, how many bits can most current modern processors, how many bits do they have within them for computing processors?
Yeah. The average CPU these days that we get from the store, like any general person, is a 64-bit architecture CPU.
Yeah. So, but it's not just 64 bits. It's 64, usually 1,000 bits that we can process within a given period of time, right?
Yeah.
So 2 years ago, the biggest quantum computer that existed was less than 90 qubits, total 90 qubits. IBM 2 years ago proposed that by this year, they would have a 1,000-qubit computer. So they would have a computer with 1,000 individual qubits in it. I haven't seen the announcement that they've made it, so I'm kind of thinking they didn't make it, but I know they passed the 400-qubit.
Yeah, that's what I read.
About a year ago. The supposition is, the guess that the computer scientists are, is that we need to get into the 1,000 to 2,000 qubit space before we can start doing general computing tasks. But even today, those purpose-built qubit quantum computers can solve mathematical problems, like the traveling salesman problem has been given against a quantum computer, and something that we thought was never going to be solved, the quantum computer can give an answer, and it is the optimized answer. And you can make one change, and it within minutes it gives you the optimized answer again and again and again.
Cool. What's the traveling salesman question?
So the traveling salesman is an old data science problem, right? If you are a traveling salesman, and let's say that you are traveling city to city to city, and you're going to 15 different cities, what is the optimum path to go between those different cities? If all options are on the table, do you go city 1, 2, 3, 4? Do you go 1, 3, 5, 4? What is the optimum path to go between those destinations as a traveling salesman? And the problem is that you get past 4 spots that the salesman needs to visit, and the mathematical problem becomes so complex that you can't answer it. It's become so difficult that it's not worth answering. Quantum computing starts to give us a ways to be able to answer questions like that.
Right. So, I mean, obviously we have these computers, with the quantum computers now, that are doing these sort of single tasks for us. They're very specialized and they're hellishly expensive, right? They have to be cooled with massive coolers. You know, it's impractical. But if we look back at our previous generation of computers, go back as recently as, say, the 1960s, those, again, were computers that took up mainframes, right? They took up an entire room or sometimes even building. They had to have specialist air control, HVAC systems. The storage was incredibly large and slow, all of these things. And generally speaking, the amount of computation, just before the 60s, I'd say probably the 40s and 50s, the computation that we used these things for was to take over from the humans. So if we even look at the NASA, the Apollo missions, right up until just before the moon landing mission, we were calling them computers. Now,
humans.
They were humans. They were working with slide rules and doing, trajectory headings. And, computers actually started out being used, or early digital computers started being used for missile trajectories and stuff like that, right? That was kind of why.
Yeah, mathematical calculations. The same category of problems that we're currently throwing at quantum computing. They're math problems. And it's a good place to start. So we've got some challenges that haven't been solved yet. So this isn't if we just get the hardware right over the next 2 years, you're going to have a quantum computing laptop sitting on your desk. We still have some technological hurdles within quantum computing that we need to solve. And you touched on one of them, the cooling one, cooling a computer down to near 0 degrees Kelvin. That's a significant environmental impact to do that. Mm. And to understand, quantum computing has a big problem with errors. Now, if we take a look at digital computing, there is this little thing that happens in digital computing where cosmic radiation causes bits within a classical computer to flip. So that the Earth is constantly being bombarded by cosmic radiation. And so occasionally you will have a bit on your computer that just flips. Mm. Storage bit flips. It can corrupt files over time. The classical computing side, we have documented that fairly extensively. Quantum computing is much worse. With quantum computing, if you look at one of the quantum particles, you de-interlace it from the other computer, the other qubit particles, and so it is no longer useful for solving the problem.
Right. And in classical computing, we've got things like error correction as well, the checksumming of things. We can often see, oh yes, this zero has gone to a one, and then flip that zero back to its correct state. So you're basically saying, hey, look, there not only do we not have effective error control checking in quantum, the chances of it being switched are astronomically higher.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay,
yes.
Cool.
Yes. And as the temperature comes up. Now, there's an exception to this. So Honeywell has done, using light waves, has done their quantum computing at a much higher temperature. It's still exceptionally cold, but it's not zero. The problem is other particles get into it. Now, one of the big races right now in the whole system is to come up with error correction for quantum computing. And IBM has published a paper that says that they believe that getting to the 1,000 qubit will allow them to do error correction. By the way, the error correction problem gets worse the more qubits you get. So it's actually, unlike classical computing, where if we get enough bits into the system, correcting for a problem with one is easier because there are less impact to it. With quantum computing, the more qubits we get into it, the more difficult it is to do error correction across everything that's being done.
Yeah.
I want to highlight something because we talked about it's 158 million times faster than classical computing. There's one particular part of current computing that is heavily dependent on calculations being made constantly, and that's encryption. And we're heavily dependent on encryption to be able to secure what we do, to secure our transactions, to store our stuff safely. We're heavily dependent on that. And the dependence we have is that encryption isn't broken. Guess what? If we have a computer that all it does is calculate at 158 million times what a current classical computer does.
Yeah, we're screwed. I mean, I could put a sort of finer point on it, but basically all of the elliptical curve cryptography that we have, all of that stuff
is at risk.
It's pretty much redundant, right? Yeah. If we can get something that if we try a normal CPU or GPU, which is actually better, it's focused on that type of encryption decryption. We could spend years decrypting a 256 bit hash, but we could actually do the decryption of that password or whatever it is that's encrypted in sort of days or minutes. Is that right in saying?
And there's a handful of encryptions that are one way encryptions. They're one way encryptions where you can't go backwards, right? So the best example of that is a blockchain. A blockchain is every time you add to it, you hash it again, and it's a one-way hash. You can't go backwards and undo what you've done.
Sure.
Guess what quantum computing can do? It can go backwards.
Yeah. Because there's so many states and processing power. Yeah.
It has the compute capacity to go backwards. So I want to go back to the original question you asked, and you asked, why would we do this? Why would we go down this path with quantum computing if so far, we've talked about how hard it is, we've talked about how expensive it is, what the environmental impact is, and, there's this massive security risk coming at us because of quantum computing. I think the opportunity with quantum computing is as great as all of those risks. We can solve problems that we've never solved before.
That's right. And if we, I keep steering the conversation to our history, but our history in this particular case, I think, tells us so much. Now, if we have a look at the big names of computing as we went into digital computing, Honeywell, IBM. Yep. Those were two big companies at that time. And for the last part of digital computing, if we look at them, you know, in the desktop era and, you know, just since basically the mid-1990s, those names have hardly been relevant at all. So they've got this now, this new sort of step change where they're looking at building this technology, which is basically mainframe-like technology. But the interesting thing is that in terms of application, and I want to ask you about application in just a second, but in terms of application, what we have today is like a mainframe infrastructure on steroids. So yeah. I'll give the analogy to that. Back in the 60s and 70s, IBM, say, for example, their System 360, what people would do with that is they would have remote terminals. They wouldn't necessarily be at the coal face of the computer. They wouldn't be in the room with this massive, big, yeah, hulking computer. They would be, you know, somewhere. They could even be dialed in. So IBM's kind of infrastructure on all of this is that everybody would be connected to a network that then would take them into this big powerhouse computer. Now, yep, we're talking about an internetwork, or, yep, as some of us call it today, the cloud. Yep. And that cloud allows us to potentially connect to these quantum computers. So you can start to, yep, extrapolate from that, I guess, and I'm just coming up with my punchline here, I guess, Sean, but basically you can extrapolate from that is once these companies do finally get to somewhere like general purpose computation from quantum computing, we'll be in a situation where these things can be connected to the cloud, and therefore, you know, it's kind of the whole thing's come full circle, but now we have so much computing power on our hands that there, yeah, can be a lot more applications. So my question to you, Sean, is when you get to that stage where we're giving general purpose computation or close to it, what do you think the applications of this are going to be or going to look like?
Yeah, and so let me touch on those, but I want to highlight something you just said. The big investments that are being made, we've mentioned IBM and Honeywell, but most of the big cloud providers are also fully baked into deploying quantum computers in cloud. Google is building their own quantum computing. In fact, they declared quantum supremacy a couple of years ago, and then they got overrun by a lab in China, and then they got over, I think they got overrun by IBM. Microsoft is partnering with somebody to bring a quantum computing. AWS is partnering with somebody. And then you have a couple of smaller startups, and I say smaller, they have billions of dollars of investment by governments and private organizations to solve this quantum computer problem. So you've got companies like D-Wave that have come out with it. And we've begun to see several, by the way, similar to the mainframe days, we don't even have common computing languages. So the Honeywell quantum computer and the IBM quantum computer and the Google quantum computer, they use different programming languages.
Oh, goodness me.
Yeah, it's like we've gone back to assembly days and doing assembly language where every piece of hardware, the assembly language was different because the hardware was different. So there are a handful of quantum computing programming languages that are starting to float around out there. There are some people that are trying to build a common one, but applications. Machine learning predictive capability is going to explode. Yes, AI is big right now, but the banks, Chase Bank, the really large banks are betting billions of dollars on quantum computing because they see it as a way to be able to build, because machine learning models are all about data and calculations. And you need something that can chew through data fast and can calculate massive calculations with massive number of variables.
Okay, so quick question then. So right now we've all been foisted into the world of AI. We kind of have, whether we like it or not, you know, we've now entered the world of AI and machine learning. And as you've just said, machine learning is all about having massive data sets, or at least the sort of, yeah, technology behind GPT is. All right. So let's think then, what does it look like if we have a world where all of that data is available, but maybe even more by the time that we got around to it? So I don't know how big the storage is for GPT right now. I mean, it's petabytes or massive, right? So let's just say that we've got even more data than that about practically everything that's ever happened in the world ever, still in a bit of storage, which can be quickly accessed. But I guess that's the accessing of it's still going to be a bottleneck. Then we have a quantum computer that compute any sort of eventuality, any particular type of outcome in an instant when it gets to the computer. What does that actually look like for the human who's interfacing with it? Now, at the moment, we've got a keyboard. We can actually do ChatGPT now with photographs, with images. You know, it's getting more and more advanced all the time. But then we take it to this massive step change. We have an awful lot more computational capability. What's it going to look like? What's the application of that?
So let's go back a little bit and look at anybody that's seen the Alan Turing movie and the mechanical computer he built. And the major problem with it was that he had a finite amount of time to be able to decrypt the message that was coming in, and his computer had to run, and it was, you know, he could never get it to decrypt the message within the period of time that it was doing it. And he needed the computer. He had to build the computer to be able to do it. So currently today, we have a lot of problems that machine learning and artificial intelligence looks like it's going to solve. Logistics problems, financial prediction problems, insurance prediction problems. Let's set aside artificial intelligence interacting with us, because that's a solution looking for a problem. But there's a massive amount of automation problems. There's a massive amount of predictive capability around weather and farming and raising of animals. And you know, there's all these problems. And we believe that machine learning can solve some of these problems. Solve the problem is probably the wrong term. We believe that machine learning can tell us when things are going to happen and can tell us what variables we can change to be able to keep bad things from happening and to make and optimize it for good things. The problem is our compute's not good enough. The compute has gotten better, and we have gotten better. But anybody that's talked to ChatGPT knows that it's stilted a little bit. You ask it a question and it comes back and ticks through the stuff. It waits for a second and then ticks through the stuff. So it's not very smooth. It's having to think about it. And that's a very simple thing of ask it a question and it gives you an answer. If you do something like help me predict the weather in Fiji tomorrow, the computer is going to tick through that problem and probably the weather in Fiji is going to arrive before the computation finishes. Quantum computing changes that. Now we have the ability to be able to ask questions of these large systems and get answers within a period of time that we'll be able to use it. Now, for standard people, you and me, what it means is that artificial intelligence begins to appear more human-like. Because the limiting factor in artificial intelligence right now is that computing power. It can't process and respond fast enough to us to seem like you're talking to a human. But with a quantum computer behind it, now you can. And it will actually turn it on its head. You and I have talked about artificial intelligence before, and I've been very clear that I don't believe artificial intelligence is going to take people's jobs. I think people that are augmented with artificial intelligence are going to be the ones that end up taking jobs. I don't think that there's not AI systems that are going to come along and just gobble up all the jobs. Quantum computing changes some of that.
So we're going to be in a world where potentially quantum computing with the application of AI and other technology is, you know, possibly going to change our lives to the point where we no longer have to think and apply our brain in the same way that we do today. Now that in itself is a very powerful statement. And it is something that we really have to grapple with before we, you know, it's right now we're having this thought with AI and going, oh, sugar, is it really the right thing? Should we have unleashed this on the masses? And that's, you know, that is still a problem that we're grappling with. But then, you know, to take that to the next level and apply quantum computing, not just to AI, but just in general, just to unleash the beast, as it were, the quantum computer itself in a general computing fashion, these are going to create a whole new raft of problems that we could never have thought about before. And obviously, one of them we touched on earlier on, that's basically the end of security and cryptography as we know it. So what we're going to have to fix or figure out before we unleash quantum computing to the masses is a new methodology. And we probably can't call it cryptography, because cryptography is a mathematical sum that we have to do. So that won't work. So we're going to have to find a new method of quantum capable security.
There are a handful of companies out there that are doing post-quantum encryption. Yeah. So that what they're doing is they're looking at what quantum can do, and I don't want to go in depth into it, because we've gotten very esoteric in quantum computing. Cryptography gets even worse, right? We start mixing quantum and cryptography. But there are some companies out there that are looking at it. And by the way, there is a dystopian viewpoint to this. Predictive financing, right? Speculative financing, gambling on the stock market, or, you know, on futures, or even going to a casino, if you have ready access to a quantum computer, that changes. But by the way, most of the financial markets today, buys and sells are being driven by machine learning models.
Sure.
So we, and if you look at, say, what a stock is trading on the market today, that's not a valuation of the physical assets of the company. That's a valuation of what the general public believes that the company will be worth in the future. Because Google is worth, you know, what did they broke the $1 trillion mark. Apple broke the $1 trillion mark, 2 years ago. But yeah, not based on physical assets, based on what they believed the company was going to be worth, what the value was there. So we're already using machine learning models. Quantum computing is just going to make that speculation more fine-pointed. It's going to be less guesswork, and it's going to be more calculation. So you're going to see stabilizations within financial markets. That would be a good thing. It means that people aren't out there getting rich by buying and selling stocks. It means that you invest and you have comfort that the financial market is going to continue the way it's going to go. Go ahead.
By that inference, then, would you claim then that it could potentially be a more equal playing field for everybody out there?
So some people have proposed that. One of the big challenges, and you pointed it out, and rightfully so, is these quantum computers are held by a very small number of companies, and they're the traditional companies. And, you know, Chase is one of the largest banks in the world, and it's investing billions of dollars in quantum computing because it sees a potential gain for itself there. Now, if it's successful, it's going to make Chase more money, which means that we may have a little bit of a problem around wealth inequality and the wealth gap and wealth pooling at the top 1% or the top 0.1%. That's also a likelihood, but the potential benefits. So AlphaFold, the machine learning model where they began figuring out all of the different ways that proteins could fold, it took quite a long time to chew through all those, much faster than the humans trying to do the same thing. But it took quite a while to do that. With quantum computing, we'd be talking minutes. You could go to quantum computing and go, here's a list of every element on the elemental table. Can you run through all of them and estimate which one is going to be the best one to build a car battery out of?
Gotcha. And again, sort of things like cancer, you know, yeah, could you, you know, have a look at this blood analysis and say,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
what's in this blood mixture that's not right, yeah, or whatever, yeah, you know, so lots of good potential. But I mean, didn't we all have the same sorts of questions about computing when it first came along? I mean, every new big thing, it's going to take our job, like it's going to change the way we live. And I guess to some extent, if we look at the introduction of computation in general from the 1950s onwards, you know, it really has factored massively into the way that humans live.
Yeah.
And some of it is good and some of it is not so good, but it's like every new technology, right?
Well, absolutely. And we're going through that right now with AI, right?
Sure.
Right now, yeah, we're living through the transformation that AI is bringing to the world and machine learning is bringing to the world. We're living through that right now. We see that. We see the benefits to it. We see the negative side to it. You and I have had a discussion about security impacts from bad actors using AI to be able to attack people. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on there. if quantum computing was just, oh, they figured out how to build processors using copper, which, by the way, they're looking into, instead of silica, because they might be able to get the copper, they might be able to get it smaller and get more processing bits onto the copper processors. It would be, if it falls within Moore's law to, you know, 1 or 2% difference, it would be much of a conversation. 158 million times faster than the biggest supercomputer we have in the world right now. That is more than a step change. That's a bloody stepping off the Great Wall of China between China and the Mongols type. I mean, there's a scale of difference at 150. It's today I have a Pentium processor and tomorrow I have 158 million times faster computer than the Pentium processor. It's the change is a level of staggeringness that is yeah.
Yeah.
We don't even know what we're going to be able to solve with it.
So let's get back to the problem that the organizations like Google and IBM and Honeywell have in transferring these fairly single purpose computers, quantum computers, into general purpose computers. What's the issue that's holding them back right now from actually making these machines do general purpose computing?
Yeah, so I mean, it's twofold. One is the programming language, because the programming language was built around solving the problem. And in fact, the computer that Google claimed quantum supremacy with, it actually, there were some people from MIT and Cambridge and a couple other places said, no, Google, you only did that for this one mathematical computation. You can't run any other math on it. So you designed the computer. You can't program it. It's literally designed at the hardware level. You give it this input, it gives you that output. And it's
okay, so it's like working out prime numbers or pi or something
Yeah. And it's almost hard-coded down to the BIOS level of the computer that's all it can do. For us to go, and by the way, it's because of the number of qubits. At the current level of qubits and the current level of error correction, that's pretty much all they can do. Now, IBM is starting to get at 400 qubits and starting to get towards 1,000 qubits. They become a little bit more extensible. You can start to put a software layer over the top of it and use the software layer to ask different sorts of questions to the qubit. But again, the big challenge is error correction. Now, there was a white paper that got published 6 months ago that talked about, there was a scientist who has begun using machine learning to predict the error correction and to fix it in path, which looks like it might be able to do it, but it hasn't been done at scale yet. It's only been done at like the 2 to 4 qubit level. 2 to 4 qubits. We have working computers out there that you can buy for under $100,000 that have 2 to 4 qubits, and they are useful for doing mathematical computations.
Hmm. That's incredible. And have you heard much of this analog computing business coming back?
Yeah, I have seen that. And in fact, as you and I know, one of the problems with digital computer is that everything's squared off, right, at the zeros and ones. With an analog computer, you can slice it thinner because, you know, it's a gradual rise and a gradual, you know, between zero and one, you have an infinite number of possible measurements that you could be doing. And so, yeah, the analog computer, it comes into fashion. It came into fashion in the 80s at universities. It comes back and forth a little bit. It's an interesting concept. But again, it's going to require an entirely new software stack. And most of the big guys aren't investing in it yet.
Yeah. So, I often wondered if there was going to be a situation where, because a lot of the things that humans do, right, we touch things, we listen to things, and we use our senses, right? So computers have to translate all of the things that we do, you know, the user interaction aspect, the computer has to translate those back into sort of analog sources. Yeah. So we're using digital analog converters to do that. And that, like you say, you know, there's, you know, we don't round them off at zero or one.
Yeah.
Whereas an analog computer deals with these analog things. You know, it's between somewhere, it's 1.2 or it's 1.5.
Yeah.
It's not quantum computing, it's analog computing. But I could foresee the possibility where analog computing might augment quantum computing. Yeah,
it would be a step between the two.
Analog, sorry, the last thing I'll say about that is that a good thing about analog computing is if you think about power hungriness, the amount of power that's required to even provide power to your, say, your phone and your wallet, your pocket, or your quantum computing is still quite high. Like a quantum computer uses massive amount of power, whereas an analog computer is practically sleeping. I mean, a battery, a standard, AAA battery could last, ages and years in that sort of a device.
And there is, look, there is value to this. So Northern Telecom, Nortel, in the United States in the 1990s, they built, so one of the big challenges with fiber is that at every switching station, the light is transformed to electronics and then transformed back into light to be sent down a different path. So you've got to make a switching decision. So Nortel built a switch in the 90s that actually switched the light. So the light would come in and it had a mirror with concave surfaces on it, and it would actually turn the mirror to send the light down a different path based on the signaling mechanism that told it which direction the light needed to go. So the light was never transformed. It actually was much faster than, standard networking capabilities within light. The problem was that it was massively expensive to implement, massively expensive to maintain, because you had to keep, if a particle dropped onto the mirror, the laser stopped working.
A little bit of dust, whatever. Yeah.
And the ultimate gain wasn't great enough to justify the costs associated with it. And I think you're right. Analog computer might give us a way to get closer to it, whether it augments quantum computing and brings it down closer to us, or it augments classical computing and brings us up closer to quantum computing. There might be something in there, and I'm sure that there are companies out there that are looking at it right now.
Yeah. All right. So obviously we've talked a lot about, getting from where we are today to general purpose. And you really, it boils down to what you said is, it probably means that we need a bigger qubit number. We need more computing power, and we need a shared language so that people can just develop for these a lot easier than where we are right now. So do you have a sort of idea of the current sort of timeline that we could be looking at?
That's the $10,000 question, right?
Well, I've got a ball on my head. I can rub that and see what happens. So it's up to you.
Look, I mean, there are companies that right now that are betting on quantum computing within the next 5 years. That's, I mean, better. Chase wouldn't be dumping $20 million US into quantum computing research without the expectation that within a short time they're going to have something usable. And let's be clear, there are things you can do with it right now. We have solved mathematical proofs that we didn't think were ever going to be solvable. So you can actually do stuff with quantum computing, actual real production level stuff. What you can't do is, as a business, you can't consume quantum computing to do general business with. I suspect that within the next 5 years, we will see quantum computing for general business. Now, there's a company, and I'm not going to remember the name of the company, but there's a company that has committed to a desktop quantum computer within the next 5 years.
So does that mean providing a desktop, like an actual physical computer with quantum power on your desktop? Or does that mean connecting to the cloud?
It's a very good question, Alistair. And the company that did it didn't go into details about what they meant by that. I'll try and dig it up and put it in the show notes. I don't remember the name of the company. I thought it was interesting at the time, the paper that they had behind it, and they had quite a bit of investment in the company. But I was also fairly skeptical because, again, error correction, massive amounts of cooling. By the way, some qubits, when they de-interlace with the other qubits, can never be recovered. So then you got to replace it. And it's not just pulling a memory chip out of a system board and putting another memory chip in. Replacing a qubit within a quantum computer, you got to bring the entire computer down. It takes days for it to get to a temperature where you can replace it. It's a massive piece of work. So you said it brilliantly at the first of this. we are at the early days, the similar early days to mainframes, and how we're going to consume quantum computing for the near future is the same way that we consumed mainframes back in the
day. Yeah. Now, but you've just said there, Sean, that you know that a lot of people are saying that's going to be about 5 years. Now, if we go back to the days of mainframes, let's say approximately 1973, 74, there were people in the world, very clever people, who said that, you know, computers, you know, there would only be about 5 or 6 computers or maybe 50 or something like that in the world. Yeah. And there would be, nobody would ever want a computer at their home. Yeah. And then fast forward to 1977, and we had a trifecta of desktop home computers, and that market exploded. And, you know, that was only within a period of 5 years. It really, really exploded. So, you know, stranger things have happened. And,
absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, up until about 5 years ago, we had working quantum computers, but in the 2 to 5 qubit range. Again, massive cooling, error correction, a whole bunch of other problems. So we've begun to solve the technical problems to get us to a working quantum computer. And, you know, IBM surpassed the 400 qubits, and they're on, probably not on track for the timeframes that they originally committed to, but they're on track to get to 1,000 qubits. And Google and the university in China, that again, the name eludes me, but they have multi-hundred qubit computers. Honeywell and D-Wave have gone slightly different directions, but they also are getting into larger qubit numbers, and so closer to a general computing level. I hate predicting out anything past 5 years, because
who knows? Too much, isn't it? Yeah. But it's a fantastic thing to think about. And I think, again, if you and I can sort of say, oh, yeah, 5 years, that might be sort of something, then I hope that, you know, people who have the power in these areas, so that's the people who are manufacturing them, and also government states are also thinking about how to regulate this level of computer.
Yes.
Because, and ultimately, it almost becomes an arms race. If we think about it again, going back to where we started with computing, it was always about missile trajectories for the Second World War. And it didn't quite make it in time, but that was why we had such an investment in digital computing back in the day. Now we could massively weaponize those sorts of technologies for a whole bunch of things that I don't even want to think about.
Well, we've already had some people in government in the US and Europe talking about a quantum arms race going on. Yep. And it's absolutely is a thing. And I would say, if you're a business owner, if your business is heavily dependent on large sums of money that you invest, or large sums of money that you buy products and move products to another place, you need to have somebody that is at least watching what's happening with quantum computing, because it will fundamentally change how you do, how you invest, where you buy products, how you ship those products. Yeah, it's compute levels. If your business is dependent on computing right now, like if you can't do your business without doing, your financing has gotten complicated enough that you have to have not just zero is a good accounting platform, but there are companies out there that have massively complex finances. And if you're dependent on computing, you need to be at least aware of what's going on with quantum computing, because it is going to change the way you do what you do.
Yeah. And I guess without that level, I mean, if you were an NYSE, a stock exchange, and then almost, I mean, because that's the thing, it's going to be almost overnight, right? This quantum computing, one day, a company somewhere or a government is going to introduce general purpose quantum computing, and that will be it. And there will be no going back. So all of a sudden, you know, you've got to embrace the technology. And so if you're like, there's a stock exchange out there that doesn't embrace it straight away, they're going to be left in the dust. And that could be quite a dangerous situation, just for starters. But I can't even begin to think of the applications and the ramifications that can come from this. I mean, it's taken us almost 60 or 70 years to get to a point where the computing has moved into our pockets and really changed. I mean, after 2007, when the iPhone came around, that was a step change again in the world of computing. And if you look at the way that we as a world consume computation, it's massively, massively changed from that point onwards, and the amount of people who are using compute, you know, and we don't even think about it. It's just augmenting our lives.
Yeah.
That again is it's going to be bigger than the iPhone moment, though, right? It's going to be huge.
Yeah, well, it won't be. We won't see the adoption the way we saw it with ChatGPT, but the underlying business and the way the markets work, the way the financial markets work, it's going to change all of that. And you know, Tim Warren had a post, and I'm going to give a shout out to Tim. Tim Warren had a post on LinkedIn the other day, and he proposed this idea around AI that business leaders need to decide to do good.
Yeah.
And I kind of tongue in cheek, and he's absolutely right. He came back and he talked with me about it. I tongue in cheek said, there's a trade-off, right? We need courageous leaders to do good instead of chasing individual profits. And he came back and he said, we can do both. And he's right. But it's going to require people to decide, I want to do good, not just I want to put a Cybertruck on the road.
Mm.
There are people in the world that want to do good. So I think we'll end on that note.
I think so. Lots of things bouncing around in my definitely non-quantum brain. Look, Sean, thank you so much for lending your vast knowledge on this ever-emergent topic. It's emerging so quickly, and it's very difficult, I know, to keep up to date with this topic specifically. So look, thanks very much for taking the time. You've been listening to the Technology Whisperers. I'm Alistair Ross.
And I'm Sean Muller.
Thanks for listening. Cheers. See ya.